Good afternoon. I'd like to call the Health and Human Services Finance Division to order. We do have a quorum present. Good afternoon, everybody. So today we are going to, as you can see from the agenda, we have three bills, and then we're going to go back to House File 3980, which we have been moving along from day to day and hopefully spend most of our time on that. So we're going to start today with House File 3510, Representative Grossel, and I understand that I should call on Representative Haley. Representative Haley.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you. I was looking at something else. I'd like to make a motion to refer this bill to capital investment.
All right. So Representative Haley moves that House File 3510 be recommended to be re-referred to capital investment. Thank you very much. And just so, just as by way of a little bit of introduction here, it's kind of unusual for Health and Human Services to have bills like this before us because this is a bill that ultimately is to build a building. And we don't do that in this committee usually. And so it's a little bit of an odd procedure, but we wanted to just give the committee an opportunity to hear a little bit about the project, even though this is not the committee that will be deciding on this project. And we will move it to capital investment. That's our intention, so that the capital investment committee can consider it in the bonding bill, basically, which is where it ultimately belongs. So with that, welcome to the committee, Representative Grossel, and please present your bill.
Thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair and committee members, for this opportunity to present the bill number 3510. It is the bill for the Red Lake Initiative project. It is a bill that the Red Lake Nation and the counties of Beltrami and the state of Minnesota has been working hard on to get moving and to keep moving. And I have with me today testifiers, if needed, the secretary from the Red Lake Nation, Sam Strong, the director of Family and Children's Services for Red Lake, Sherry Goodwin, and then also from Beltrami County, Human Services Director for Beltrami County, Becky Secor, and also tagging along with us too and supporting us, Red Lake Minnesota Government Affairs Director Donna Bergstrom. And Madam Chair, with that being said, this building project, like I said, is very important to keep the process that has already been started for the Red Lake Nation, for this initiative project, to keep it moving now. And I will. I know that brevity is our friend in situations like this. So to respect your time and the committee's time, Madam Chair, I'll throw it and I'll put the ball back in your court as to how much testimony is needed today.
All right. Well, thank you, Representative Grossel. I really appreciate that. And so I think this is a really important project, and I think it would be good to share just a little bit with the committee, maybe just for, you know, 3-4 minutes. And I don't know, Mr. Strong, if that would be you would be the person to do that. That would be great if you would introduce yourself and welcome to the committee.
Definitely. Well, bonjour, bimose, gnu, indigena, kas, mokwundu, dem, miskwaga, mwiza, gunning, and ndojaba. Hello, Madam Chair and committee. Thank you for hearing us and taking this time to hear about this very important bill for Red Lake. As many of you are aware, we're experiencing a lot of problems with out-of-home placement within our community. And many of these problems were perpetuated by both actions of the federal government and the state government through boarding schools, historical trauma, and many other instances of oppression that the government has imposed on our community. And although none of you were there when this happened, this is an opportunity for the state to take some corrective action and give us the capacity to serve our own children. If you come to Red Lake, you'll see that a lot of our people are in poverty. A lot of our people are experiencing drug addiction and other mental health disorders. And it all starts with our children. If we're going to really, truly change our community, we need to bring about generational change. And this building has the opportunity to do that. This building has the opportunity for us to provide the mental health services, to provide the different capacity that we need to really serve these much at-risk youth. And not only the youth, but the families. And so we're calling it an intergenerational building because we intend to serve the families of all of our communities. And the only way we can heal our community is through that intergenerational healing. And so what that means is we'll have the opportunity to not only serve the children, but the entire community and lay the groundwork to truly change some of these incredibly troubling statistics that you will see about our community. And so we're asking for your support in that regard, and we're asking for your not only your support, but for you to continue to look at these issues and help ensure that we're on the right path and that we've been given the tools necessary to succeed. I know for many of us, this is of the utmost importance. I'll just take a quick example of why this is so important. You know, when you talk about drug addiction, you know, one of the biggest factors in pushing people further into addiction is separating families. And so one of the things this will help us do is to reunite families and give a path for the parents and the kids to stay off drugs, give a path for our community to better educate all of our community members about historical trauma and about the things that we can do to better these issues that our communities are faced with. And if you don't mind, I would like our director to just say some quick words. She's been spearheading this particular initiative, and I know it's something within all of our hearts, but I ask for you to think of the children and to think of all those hundreds and hundreds of children that are impacted by out-of-home placement and by really the system that has oppressed our people. And I ask you to be a part of that change and to be a part of that reconciliation of all the harm that has happened to our indigenous community. So again, miigwech for hearing this, and miigwech for everyone for taking the compassion and the humanity of looking at our community and trying to help us be self-sustainable and help us serve all of our community members and bring about true change. So miigwech.
Thank you, Mr. Strunk. Thank you for that message. Welcome to the committee. Please give us your name and go ahead.
Good afternoon, everybody. My name is Sherry Gooden. I oversee the Family and Children's Services Red Lake Nation, which we recently enacted a name change, which is Obimindwa. Basically, what we want to do is uplift our relatives because the system, all child welfare in the state of Minnesota, was based on a punitive way of doing business. So we're really re-looking at how we're doing business with our families, uplifting their spirits, uplifting them to do more intensive services. And that's where we mentioned family preservation. But thank you, too, to all the members of the chair. So I've been the director since 2015, myself and Becky Secor, Beltrami County, been working hand-in-hand to release Beltrami County of its financial responsibilities so Red Lake Nation can oversee both the legality and the financial pieces of child welfare. And I'm happy to say today we ran some numbers, and this is going to sound crazy, but last year we returned 182 kids home, either through permanency or North Star Kinship. Now, to me, that's a big deal, and that is by doing this new innovative way of doing business. But with that said, we are out of space. We're in order for us to do the tribal child welfare initiative, last year you appropriated that money. Thank yous, miigwech, through the Minnesota Department of Human Services. So we are in planning phases. We're ready to go live 1/1/21. But with that said, we need to increase our staff to do the 4E requirements, to do all these different requirements that are necessary in order to be successful. So we're out of space, and I believe in the wraparound services, and Secretary Strong briefly talked about that, is that we need to be providing, you know, behavior health, public health nursing, all these different components that other counties, other small towns have services available, which we don't have. So we lack services on the nation, and that's why our disparity numbers are so high. So I'm here to say today, I'm educated, I'm ready, and we want to drop these disparity numbers once and for all, save the state of Minnesota and the federal government money, but I need the physical space to do these services. You know, we can't afford to go into debt on our disparity numbers, so we're asking for this one-time ask of, I believe it's like $8.6 million, which is, I'm a state taxpayer, just like everybody else. I live and pay my taxes, so I believe that it's a big deal, and I think we, Red Lake Nation, will make everybody proud, and I think that this all the counties in the state will be looking at our model because we do have a practice model. We did a lot of work to get ready. So I think we have 298 days till 1/1/21. But miigwech, and I'm here for questions, and if anybody has any more questions. But I wanted, hopefully, Tina, Madam Chair, Becky could say a few words of the support Beltrami County has to miigwech.
Okay, well, thank you. Thank you very much. Welcome to the committee. If you could just be really brief, thank you.
Very brief. Becky Secor, Beltrami County
you
Health
can
and
pull the mic over. There
Health
you
and
go.
Human Services. I just want to say I've been honored to work with partners at Red Lake. Cherry and I have been working hand in hand over the last 5 years, and ultimately I think it's the cultural services that are going to make a difference for these children, and I believe strongly in that, and Beltrami County fully supports this bill.
Thank you very much. Well, you are all hitting themes that are of great concern to this committee, so thank you very much for that. Representative Keel.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you for great to hear your project, and I'll just point out that I live just west of Red Lake, represent that area, but what I wanted to know was where are you planning to put this building?
So we've identified a spot on the Red Lake Nation. It's basically going to be on like Highway 1 right next to the new store. I think you've seen our new store since you're a neighbor.
Yes.
We want to put it right there on the side of the old store.
Okay.
So we'll be ready. I know Donna, our government affairs person, asked to the committee once, are you ready? Are you site dirt ready? We're ready. You know, we got to move fast because initiative is coming fast. So we do have some planning funds that we were awarded through you guys. So we have an architect. We have a project manager. So we have some designs, some schematic designs. I could have brought them, but Donna said, no, leave them in the car. Just kidding. But no, we are ready. It's really exciting. So I hope that answered that question.
Yeah.
There's definitely no site control problems.
Oh, yes.
Representative Keel.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And my other question would be is we were privileged in January of 2019 to have a hearing. Was it in Mille Lacs? I can't remember. Anyway, and we heard about some programs they were working on with their, it was a multiple tribes, and I don't remember if Red Lake was there. I don't think so, but anyway, and we were hearing about what they were doing to help their families be stronger and deal with the opioid abuse and their, you know, just the problems with drugs in general. And I was really encouraged by a couple of young people that were working on some new ideas and wondered if you had had any contact with them at all or...
We have relationship through the commission where the 11 tribes meet together through the DHS. But what we're doing is changing the face. So it's all about relationship building because I'm a social worker. So I'm MSW and a licensed graduate social worker. But it's about building relationships, right? It's got to be opening them doors and come in. Welcome, Senator Grasso. You know, really building that. I didn't mean to touch you. Sorry. Jeez.
Okay. All right.
Jeez, well, maybe that's next. Just
all
kidding.
Right. So,
sorry.
You
know, sorry, house.
Okay.
Sorry.
Okay.
But anyway, so that's what
is good
it's all about building relationships.
Thank
that's
you.
That's what it
all
is.
Right.
Miigwech.
And thank
all
you,
right.
Madam Chair. I really appreciate that. And that was really where they were emphasizing it was the interrelationships between the families. And I wish you the best.
All right. Thank you. We're going to go to Representative Moran, and then we're going to vote on the bill so we can get it on its way.
Okay.
Representative Moran.
Thank you, Chair. Thank you, Chair Liebling. And I just want to say thank Representative Groeschel for to being a leader in leading on this, and just say thank you for bringing this bill to the state. And I think it's really important to talk about that history of, you know, the boarding schools and the separation of families that happened so many years back. And the impact of that is what we see today within the nations, the seven nations of the indigenous community. And that it is incumbent of us at the state to recognize the sovereign nation that you are, but to also help with correcting some of the ills of the past. And this is part of doing that and recognizing the value of family and that family preservation is important within the indigenous community, right? And that those wraparound services, but also that cultural healing piece, and that needs to be done by and with the indigenous community themselves, right? And so I'm excited to be able to support this bill and helping the indigenous community to grow, heal, and move forward, and doing that collectively from birth, you know, even before birth, to looking at the adults in the community because it has been a toll. So I'm excited to see this partnership and relationship that we're doing in our state to helping the indigenous community move forward. So again, thank you for your work. Thank you for carrying the bill. And I look forward to our state doing more. Thank you.
All right. Thank you, Representative Moran. So with that, Representative Haley renews her motion that House Bill 3510 be re-referred to the Committee on Capital Investment. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
All opposed, no. The motion prevails. Thank you very much for coming today.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Get him, Senator.
Representative Hassan, House File 3449. And Representative Hassan is the chair will move that House File 3449 be recommended for re-referral to the Committee on Capital Investment. So welcome, and members, I think this is a bill that's sort of in the same posture. It really is similar. It's actually to build brick and mortar, but it's for a project that we'd like to hear a little bit about, and it's going to capital investment, which is really where it belongs because we don't build brick and mortar in this committee. But anyway, we're fairly pressed for time today. If you could just be brief, but we want to hear what the concern is and we want to hear what the project does. So welcome to the committee, Representative Hassan.
Thank you, Madam Chair. We will be very brief. I just want to ask everyone, you have a letter in your packet?
One pager.
So just one pager, double-sided. If not, we can just pass that around.
Thank you.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair and members. Today we have House File 3449, which pertains to capital investment appropriating money to the Native American Community Clinic in Minneapolis. NAC is nationally recognized community health clinic and federally qualified health center located in South Minneapolis that provides comprehensive and behavioral health, dental, primary care services to the Twin Cities Native community in my district. In 2019, NAC served about 4,300 patients, 94% whom live below the 200% of the poverty guidelines, and 85% who were Native Americans. As the research indicates, Native American patients have far worse health outcomes than their white counterparts. And somebody echoed on that earlier on the historical trauma and separation of family. So I won't say it all over again. Substance use and mental health issues significantly and disproportionately affect the Native American community. I know we're very short on time, so in the interest of time, I have a testifier here with me, so I will move to hear his testimony. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Representative Hassan. Welcome to the committee. If you would just say your name for the record and go ahead and please give us your testimony.
Sure. Buju and Miigwech for offering me some time to talk about the clinic. My name is Anthony Stately. I am Dr. Anthony Stately. I am the CEO of the Native American Community Clinic since 2016. And essentially what we're asking you to support this bill is because the Native American Community Clinic is asking to purchase the, we're looking for funds to purchase the building that we've been operating in for the last 17 years. And we have operated in one half of the building for that period of time. We have a one-time opportunity to purchase this building from the owners who have given us an opportunity to purchase the building, and there it will allow us to expand into the other side of the building and essentially increase our footprint from 11,000 square foot to about 21,000 square feet. NAC in the last 2 years, or 3 years under my direction, we've significantly expanded our services in addressing the opiate crisis. We've opened an intensive outpatient treatment program in partnership with the Red Lake Nation that operates off-site across the plaza from us, again, because we're out of space. We've also had to move our behavior health, outpatient behavior health clinic across the plaza in another rented space because we had gotten a successful grant from the SAMHSA from Substance Abuse and Mental Health Services Administration to open up on-site dosing clinic to provide Suboxone to people living in our community seeking to recover from opiate use disorder. So the biggest challenge that NAC has is that we have been very, very successful in competing to get federal and state awards to deliver critical services in substance abuse, mental health, and primary care. And dental care over the last 3 years, we've significantly increased our capacity to compete in that market. None of those grants pay for space. None of it pays for bricks and mortar and infrastructure. We are running out of space. I have to keep off-siting programs and parts of our building off campus, so to speak, and it's very challenging for operations. This opportunity is going to significantly improve our capacity to function better, serve more patients, and significantly impact the health and well-being of the Minneapolis, or the metropolitan urban Indian community. Minneapolis, by the way, the metropolitan area of Minneapolis-St. Paul is home to the largest concentration of Native Americans living off-reservation in an urban environment in the United States. So we're not the largest number of patients. People living in an urban area, but we're the largest concentration within the South Minneapolis corridor. And that's an important investment that we make in serving the health needs of that community. And this will be a large step in supporting our continuation for the next several decades.
All right. Well, thank you very much for being here today and for telling us about your project. And as you heard on the last presentation, these are issues that are of great concern to this committee, even though this committee doesn't do the brick and mortar, but we're very happy to hear about your project and about your clinic. So thank you for the good work that you do.
We appreciate your
support. Are there any questions from members? All right, seeing none, the chair will...
Madam Chair, can I just add one more thing?
Oh, yes, certainly, Representative Hassan, sorry.
Just the last words. Madam Chair and members, this legislation is about healthcare accessibility. It's about equity, and it's also about continuing servicing our Minneapolis Native community in their clinic with their preferred methods of better health outcomes. I hope you can support us. Thank you.
All right. Thank you, Representative Hassan. And I should say, I should ask if there's anyone in the room who wants to testify for or against the bill as well. And I don't see anyone. So I think with that being said, so the chair will renew the motion that House File 3449 be recommended to be referred to the Committee on Capital Investment. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
All those opposed, no. The motion prevails. Thank you very much for being here.
Thank you.
For your time. I appreciate it.
Okay, let's see. We are hoping to take up Representative Morrison's bill. And Mr. McQuillan stepped out to get her. So in the meantime, while we are waiting, we're going to devote the bulk of our time this afternoon to an amendment to House File 3980. And I just want to note, we've passed that out to members. There are also copies available for the public. And so if anyone wants to grab a copy and start to read that, we will go through it when we get to that bill. So, you know, don't be concerned if you don't get a full chance to read it. We will walk through it because it is a significant change from the previous version.
Thank you.
Okay, we're ready for Representative Morrison. No rest. We're just moving right along here, Representative Morrison. Okay, so the chair will move House File 3892 to be, let's see, this one is to lay over for possible inclusion in the supplemental budget bill. Welcome to the committee, Representative Morrison, and go ahead and please present your bill.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Madam Chair and members of the committee, thank you for allowing me to present House File 3892, which would extend postpartum health insurance for women from 60 days to 12 months postpartum. Few events are more tragic than the death of a woman during labor and delivery or in the postpartum period. The ripple effects in a family and a community are profound, lifelong, and generational. As a practicing OBGYN, I have been horrified by the increasing maternal mortality rates in the United States, while these rates have been in steady decline around the globe. The U.S. maternal mortality rate has increased from 7.2 deaths per 100,000 live births in 1987 to 18.4 deaths per 100,000 live births in 2018. And the data indicate that more than half of these deaths should have been preventable. And according to recent CDC reports, Black and American Indian women are 2 to 4 times more likely to die from pregnancy-related causes than their white counterparts. This disparity is unacceptable. This issue deserves the full attention of America's healthcare providers and policymakers. Many pregnancy-related deaths occur postpartum, including beyond the initial few months after birth. The CDC has found that 1 in 3 pregnancy-related deaths occurs between 1 week and 1 full year after birth. This figure does not include deaths related to suicide or overdose, which are also leading causes of pregnancy-related deaths in a growing number of states. Federal statute covers a baby born to a mother on Medicaid through the first year of life. It seems obvious now that mother and baby should have the same coverage. Closing the critical gap in coverage during this vulnerable time can mean the difference between life and death for some women. This bill differs slightly from what other like-minded advocates around the country are pushing. Our bill would move these mothers from Medicaid when they lose coverage at 60 days to Minnesota Care through 12 months postpartum. It would also require the Department of Human Services to study methods on how best to ensure continuous health coverage for women and infants after the 60-day postpartum federal benefit ends. And I have a testifier with me.
All right. And before we go there, just members can see that there is a fiscal note in your packets. And thank you. And if we could just get a really brief testimony, because we're kind of pressed for time. So just really brief. And this is a fiscal committee, and this bill's been through policy. And then just if there are a few questions maybe on the fiscal note. So welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee. My name is Dr. Christy Boris, and I'm a member of the Minnesota section of the American College of Obstetricians and Gynecologists. I'm here representing Minnesota ACOG in support of House File 3892. As of today, as Representative Morrison explained, Medicaid coverage ends at 60 days postpartum. And while we recommend that patients return for a postpartum visit to ensure ongoing health maintenance, across the nation, only about 40% of women actually are able to attend that visit. Postpartum care is vital for ensuring ongoing health of the mother, including health screening, support for breastfeeding, continued management of chronic diseases. Even if all women could potentially access that care, complications really aren't limited to a 60-day deadline. It's very arbitrary, and we know that this has disastrous consequences for the health of moms. I'm going to cut my testimony short just in response to your request, but I'm happy to take any questions, and because we care deeply about positive outcomes for mom and baby, not just the baby.
Thank you very much. And this is such an important topic, and I regret that we don't have more time to really discuss it today. But I didn't move the amendment, though, and we do have an amendment in the package, and I think it's a technical amendment, it looks to me, the A1. So is that yours, Representative Morrison?
Yes, Madam Chair.
All right. So the chair will move the A1 amendment to get the bill in the shape in which the author would like to have it. Is there any discussion to the amendment? Seeing none, all those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, no. The motion prevails. So we have the bill as it is needed to be. And then questions from members? Okay, not seeing any, but any. Is there anyone else in the audience who would like to testify for or against this bill? And I'm not seeing anybody there. So any concluding words, Representative Morrison?
Thank you, Madam Chair and members, for considering what I believe to be a very important move for the state of Minnesota to make sure that we're providing adequate care to our new moms.
Thank you, Representative Morrison. Yeah, you know, there's a lot of, we hear a lot of things, and of course, concern for the health and well-being of new babies and their moms is high on our list. So thank you very much for being here today. And with that, House File 3892, as amended, is laid over for possible inclusion in the supplemental budget bill. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Madam Chair.
All right, so we're gonna, I'm gonna move House File 3980. And, or I'm gonna actually take, yes, thank you. So I'm gonna take House File 3980 from the table. Do I need a vote for that? No, okay. And so I'm going to move the DE6-1 amendment, put the bill in the order in which I would like to discuss it today. Can we do that? And then we'll discuss what we have before us, if that's okay with members. So all those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
All opposed, no. The motion prevails. So as members know, this is an issue that's moving very, very quickly. And, you know, every day as we get more news, I think what we become concerned that we want to be in the best possible position vis-a-vis our health system in the state to be able to respond, prepare for, and respond to the COVID-19 issue. So that's what this bill is about, as members know, and it started off as a loan fund, and you'll see that this has morphed a little bit. We've done significant work on this bill. And so, I didn't really prepare for this. Ms. Clark, do you want to walk through it? Maybe that would be the best thing, or maybe, it would be best if you could walk through it, I think, and just explain what's in here now. Thank you. Ms. Clark,
Madam Chair and members, I'll try to raise the significant changes, and I'll apologize in advance if I forget something. So the first change is on page one of the bill. There's a new definition added on line 1.10, a definition of eligible provider, and that's where all the provider types that could receive a grant or loan under this program are listed. And this definition was also modified to specify that long-term care facilities are included, including but not limited to hospitals, nursing facilities, or settings where assisted living services are provided. One of the big changes made throughout the bill is this program is now a grant and loan program, so a provider could receive a grant or a loan for eligible costs, depending on the type of cost that the provider needs to incur. Let's see, on page three, in subdivision 6, paragraphs A and B lists the allowable costs for grants and those for loans. So a provider could receive a grant for the items listed starting on line 3.20 through 3.30. And then on page 4, a provider could receive a loan for the costs on lines 4.2 through 4.4. Subdivision 7, starting on line 4.5, is a new subdivision, and it says that as a condition of accepting a grant or loan, the provider must agree not to bill uninsured patients for services related to screening, testing, or treating for COVID-19. On page 5, subdivision 10, this data classification language is modified to reflect some language that's being considered in the Judiciary Finance and Civil Law Committee. It keeps some data submitted as part of the application process private. Then following the application process, when an applicant receives a grant or loan, most of the of that application data becomes public, except in paragraph B, there are the listed items that the data remain private or non-public. Starting on line 5.14, section 2 is a new section. This amends the public health response contingency account language, and it adds a new clause 12. And it allows money from that account to be used for payments to ambulance services providers, clinics, healthcare and long-term care facilities, and health systems for the costs necessary to plan, prepare, or respond to a pandemic influenza or a communicable or infectious disease. And then in section 3, there are two transfers made, one to the new healthcare response account and one to the public health response contingency account.
All right. Thank you very much, Ms. Clark. No, that was very good. And let me just kind of emphasize for folks what we're doing here. So as you may notice, the biggest change from the previous version is that this is now a grant and loan program. We heard a lot from providers that with concern that a lot of the expenses they may incur are not the kind of thing that is going to give them something that's going to persist. Okay, so what we've done is in addition to still keeping the discretion pieces, the guidance around the discretion of who's eligible, in other words, you have to be, you have to show a need. And there's language in here about what would guide the commissioner's discretion about who can get money out of the account. But the issue about grants versus loans is divided now by what kind of thing you're going to need to buy. So if it's more disposable things or things like staff time or transportation, those kinds of things would be eligible for grant funding. Things that are more durable, like you're going to build more negative airflow rooms or doing something that's going to have more durable addition to your facility into the future, would be eligible for an interest-free loan under terms that are set out here in the bill. So you can see that we're trying to really strike a balance here with the great concern about the potential needs across the state in order to respond to the virus and the potential burden of illness that may occur. We want to have the flexibility here while still keeping not just going out and just buying a bunch of stuff that'll just then be out there after the emergency that'll just have been given away that really should be paid for by some of these entities if they're able over time to pay for it. So we are trying to strike that balance. The other thing that's a big change here from the other version, the department and we are very concerned that there may be real emergency needs that have to be met right away. Mm-hmm. The process here under the fund that's being set up requires the Department of Health to do some processing. They're not just going to, somebody asks and the money goes out the door. There's some investigation, an application that has to be done. The concern is there's going to be a time delay under this loan and grant fund for money to go out the door. And so there could be real emergent issues where money needs to go out much quicker than that. And so that's why we're proposing to put $20 million into the contingency fund. This is the same fund that we already appropriated money into for the public health response. That fund has a structure around it. So it can only be tapped with a certain process that the commissioner has to go through. And we're adding a provision, and let me find that language here. We're adding a provision to the fund language for this kind of use that we're thinking about. And let's see if Ms. Barkus, where's that language?
Madam Chair, I think it starts on line 6.8.
6.8, oh, thank you. Okay. So if you look at line 6.8, members, there's a section that we're adding to the contingency fund. So this is already in law. Remember, and a lot of it is reproduced here in the bill, the existing language. And we're adding a clause that would allow some of this money to be used not just for reimbursement, which is already in the fund. If you look at line 6.4, it says reimbursement to healthcare organizations for costs incurred. What we're doing here is making some money available potentially if it's needed by entities in order to prepare on an emergency basis to plan for, prepare for, or respond. So that's different than reimbursing them, which means they've already spent money and now we're going to come back and reimburse. This is to meet the concern that we could need to push some money out to some entities like really soon. And this would, since it's in the contingency fund, it still has to be authorized by the LAC at the very least, which is a process that can move fairly quickly, as we saw just now with tapping the $4.6 million that was already in the fund. So we thought that struck a good balance of having funds immediately available, but also having a little bit of structure and approval around that, so it's not just handing a pot of money to the commissioner and saying, here, go spend it. So I don't know if that's clear enough. I would be really happy to take questions on this. And we have people in the room that may very well want to testify on this and be happy to hear from them as well. Representative Baker.
Thank you, Madam Chair. As well, thank you for working on this project nobody wants to be a part of, and all the staff and writing legislation quickly on this. So I want to make sure that I understand this $20 million, and then I see the other $79 million. Is that $20 million on top of what we did earlier this week, which was a 21? So this is going to be basically now $40 million going into that emergency fund. I see you're nodding, so that I'll take that as a yes. Thank you. And my other question would be, how do we limit or recognize other health systems, i.e. does this count for home health, residents at home that need any additional services because of this, or treatment facilities, things that are not hospitals but that are in the medical system? I just want to be sure that those types of medical facilities are in that same pipeline.
Thank you for your question, Representative Baker. We broadened. First of all, I was nodding yes. Our point here is the first $21 million that was appropriated, that's already been signed by the governor, that was for very specific needs that are the public health response. And those were all laid out in the budget that were given to us. And that and the money that was already in the fund, approximately $25 million, is already designated for the public health response. This is in addition to that, and this would be designated for providers if there's an emergency where money has to go to providers. So critical access hospital, let's just say that there's a big outbreak in some part of the state where there's a critical access hospital and they don't have capacity and they need it now for, say, overtime cost.
Yeah.
This $20 million could be moved very quickly with some you know, with some checks and balances there, but could be moved very quickly to start that response. And then, because the rest of this is going to take a bit more time to process and get out the door, as it should, because, you know, this is really hard. We all want to balance the absolute need that we recognize could be there with our wanting to be responsible with public funds and make sure that we don't kind of overreact and, you know, we don't want to throw money around. As is often said, you know, let's not just throw money at the problem. We want to make sure that we target our resources where they're really needed, but make sure they can go quickly when that's needed. So you asked about who's in it, and I'm looking for the language that expands who the providers are under this. We tried to make it pretty inclusive. Let's see. Eligible provider, which is on line 1.10. And so it's pretty broad. Yeah, it's pretty broad. And then, you know, what the allowable expenses are. This is not intended to provide assistance, I would say, to people in their own homes so much. You know, I don't, if you're a homeowner, this isn't going to, you're not going to be able to say, oh, I'm going to need to buy, you know, air filter or something. I don't know what it would be. That's not for homeowners. This is for the health system.
And Madam Chair, and thank you for that. I think it's more for my folks in rural Minnesota, the home health services, if they are, if they also have the overtime needs, if there is a larger cry for more visits, that their system won't be overloaded as well. So I think it's not for the homeowner, it's really for the services that are providing those, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Representative Baker. You know, this might be a good one. We do say healthcare provider. I think they're included in that. Maybe, I don't know if we need someone to come down and speak to that. Or maybe I could ask Ms. Barkvist if she's able. Do you think that would include a home health provider? Would this language healthcare provider? Or here's Margaret Kelly's gonna come down.
Thank you.
She's our expert here. Good afternoon, welcome to the committee.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair and committee members. I'm happy to answer that question, but I would just like to remind everybody, if you're feeling ill, you should stay home. If you're at work and you're feeling ill, you should go home, and you should wash your hands. We would consider home care providers to be health care providers. Assisted living and other types of housing services are not health care providers. But if they're providing health care, then we would include them in that definition.
Thank you. And, you know, Ms. Kelly, could you just state your name for the record?
Yes, Margaret Kelly, Minnesota Department of Health Deputy Commissioner.
Okay, thank you so much. Maybe you should just stay there for a bit.
Yeah, my final question, Madam Chair, I'll be done.
Baker.
Just again, I was asking about, again, residential treatment facilities as well. Where do they fall in?
Madam Chair, Representative, to the extent that there is health care being provided at the residential treatment facility and not just housing, I'm not sure, but they would also be covered by the Department of Human Services, I believe, and their services.
I know some of those have, Madam Chair, some of those have wraparound services, nursing. I want to make sure they are also included. I get it's not just for sober homes and things like that. I understand that completely. I just wanted to make sure we're clear on that. So.
Madam Chair and Representative,
Ms. Kelly,
it would be the wraparound services to the extent that they are health care,
right,
that they would be eligible.
Thank you, yes.
All right, thank you. Representative Munson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I have quite a few concerns about this bill. I mean, questions for you I would have is, it's my understanding we just received $10 million in funding from the CDC in addition to the $21 million that we authorized from the state. Is that correct?
I will turn that over to Ms. Kelly, because I'm not really, I know that was what we were told, but I'm not really sure what the path of that funding is or what it's able to be used for, Ms. Kelly.
Madam Chair, Representative, we have been told by our congressional delegation that we should expect to see 90% of last year's public health emergency preparedness grant being awarded to us for response. And our estimate is that is about $10 million. We have yet to see any notification from the federal government that we are getting that amount.
Representative Munson.
Thank you. And that, just to be clear, that's part of the $8.2 billion that was signed by the president for this preparedness. And I just wanted to verify I heard you correctly. Do we get $10 million a year or roughly a little bit more than that a year for preparedness money for this to the same channel? Is that correct?
Ms. Kelly.
Madam Chair and Representative, yes, we do get an award. Every state gets a public health emergency preparedness award that funds both state government, local governments, and healthcare, regional healthcare coalitions on preparing for public health emergencies. And that funding is only for preparing. It's not for planning. It's for preparing and planning. It is not for response. And so they are in the $8.2 billion is a bump for every state to actually respond to the emergency.
Okay. Yeah, Representative Munson.
And Madam Chair, just a question on your bill or the amendment on line 4.7, where this is the subdivision 7 that talks about the condition of accepting the grant or loan. So any healthcare provider that would be receiving this money would not be able to bill uninsured patients for services related to screening, testing for, or treating, which I didn't know there was a treatment available for COVID-19. But I just have concerns around the uninsured because people with insurance that have high deductibles, you know, I mean, my experience going in to get tested for SARS was well over $1,000, and that would tell me that, I mean, there's not a treatment for it, so what they're going to do is test you and then send you home to deal with it. So I don't know if it's – I know that insurance companies have said that they won't be charging people deductibles, my understanding. Several of them said that, but can you just verify that what treating COVID-19 would entail, and is that hospitalization and the stay if need be?
So, Representative Munson, I should probably answer this because actually this is my language, and it's the Health Department hasn't even had a chance to really vet this part of it. So, the thought was, first of all, I mean, I can't really answer the question about treating. I think treating entails whatever you have to do to support the person medically, and obviously in this disease, some people need quite a bit of medical support. Now, maybe technically they're not treating it in the sense that there's no identified drug or process to do that, but certainly putting people on ventilators and stuff, I would consider that treating. I maybe Ms. Kelly can kind of confirm that piece of it, but or even Ms. Clarkvist, I don't know. But I think that's the sort of the – actually, we have physicians, too, who can maybe confirm what they consider to be treating, you know, or if we can change the word if necessary. But in terms of, I hear part of your question is a potential sort of unfairness between people without insurance versus those who have high deductibles. And what, to that I would say that Representative Schultz has another bill that should be dealing with that piece of it. And so, but my thought was in putting this into this bill, that when entities are, you know, one of the last things we want to do in this outbreak is have people be discouraged from seeking care or seeking a test because they are worried about the cost. If people are going to stay home and not get tested or not get treated and not, you know, that is something that hurts everybody. And so I think we need to remove that barrier as much as possible. And that's the thought behind this section. And I know Representative Bierman's seeking recognition too, so maybe I'll go to him and then, but just to note that Representative Schultz has a bill that's dealing with that very issue, so it should not be a barrier for anyone because it's in all of our interests for everyone who needs the testing or the treatment to get it. Representative Bierman.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I too want to thank you for the speed of this bill. I know there's a lot here, and but, you know, we're all fielding calls about this now, too, and I have care centers calling me, asking me what they do next, and they're hiring staff now. They're getting prepared, and their question is, how do we apply, and how soon might we see any funds? And I know those are difficult questions, but I thought if anyone could answer them, you could, Madam Chair.
Well, thank you, Representative Bierman. As I often tell my constituents, I may not know the answer, but I often know who to ask. So I think the person to ask might be sitting in front of us here. But let me just give my little piece of that first, Ms. Kelly can respond. But the point of doing this the way we're doing it, having kind of these two different buckets, is because we recognize that some money might be urgently needed. And that, you know, but there will be an application process here. And, you know, so some of this could take a little time, and I'll let her speak to that. So anyway, I'll turn it over to you, Ms. Kelly.
Madam Chair, Representative, that's a good question. We will need to design the application process and the application forms and any grant application or loan application materials. That can take some time. We will engage our partner agencies to expedite that to the extent we can. It has been very reassuring and to see the extent to which other state agencies are reaching out to the Department of Health right now to see how they can help us in responding to this outbreak. So I would anticipate whatever help we ask for from other agencies, especially the Department of Administration and Minnesota Management and Budget, to expedite a grant making process or a contracting process, that they will help us with that. But we will likely put information on our website for people to go to when it's available.
All right. Thank you, Madam Chair. And just one other question I had, which is maybe a little off of this topic, but a very real need, is a question about where we stand on testing and test kits, and if the state is doing anything to move that process forward, because that's such a critical aspect. And without testing, we don't know the scope of what we're up against. Could you comment on that as well,
please? Ms. Kelly?
Madam Chair and Representative, we have received test kits from the CDC. The issue is not the number of test kits we have. Actually, the issue is the supplies that we need in our laboratory to run the tests. And so while we have kits currently on hand to run 3,000 tests, we only have the supplies to run, at this point in time, to run about 800 tests. And we're talking supplies like the chemicals that you need to actually run the tests, little tips that you put on the end of the instruments to help you run the tests. And there are shortages nationwide for these supplies. We are reaching out to our vendors. They are rationing, so to speak, not letting people order huge volumes, which we appreciate that they're doing. We are working with the federal government to authorize the FDA, to allow the FDA to authorize different methodologies for testing as well, so that we can increase our capacity. At this time, Mayo Clinic is starting to test, and that will increase the capacity we have in the state, but at the same time, they will face similar challenges around laboratory supplies.
Okay, Representative Bierman. Okay, Representative Haley.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just a number of questions I want to, since it's the Finance Committee, and thanks again for the work that you've put in and staff. So I want to understand the process of this loan versus grant. So the way I read this, MDH determines grant or a loan, and the language says no interest loans. So have we kind of called that out, that all these loans are no interest? Yesterday we had some discussion on different mechanisms of doing that. So that's my first question.
Thank you, Representative Haley. Thanks for reminding me about that piece. Yeah, after some discussion, it seemed that it just injected a complication into this, both on the point of figuring out what that interest rate should be, and then for anybody who might need the loan to then kind of be thinking, calculating that in, and then there's collecting it and figuring it out. And it just seemed that in this instance, it would be simpler to not have. And then, you know, the Department of Health is not really, we would have had to decide what that was going to be and the terms. Mm-hmm. And, you know, just given the, you know, I don't know if everyone is going to agree with that. If you have a different point of view on it, I would be totally open to hearing it. But I just decided that would be cleaner that way.
Okay. Thank you, Madam Chair. And then a follow-up. The language also says that with the title, this is a revolving account. So do we anticipate then that as those loans get paid back, this money goes back into this fund and we kind of, until this crisis has abated, I guess, if we continually want a certain amount of money in the account? I'm not sure if I read terms on when they have to repay those back. Can you talk to that?
Yeah, thank you. In here it does, okay, let's see. We've got loan repayment section starting on line 4.9. And again, you know, the things that the points in here, the points in time are somewhat arbitrary. And again, I'd welcome input onto them. But so we say that the loan recipient must begin repaying no later than a year after. So we want to give some time, you know, and then they could get an extension because of financial hardship or continuation of the outbreak. So it is, we are not thinking that this money will come back soon into the account, right? Because it's loans and grants, I'm certainly not expecting that the fund would be replenished. I mean, you know, we have to be thinking that this is money, that a lot of it is going to go out in grants. But the purpose of having both in here again is so that certain, you know, long-term capital changes, certain long-term equipment purchases that we're not just paying for them when they might become part of a healthcare entity's ongoing operations. And then over time, they should be able to pay that back. So that's kind of the thinking there, to, you know, limit that we're not just giving away a bunch of stuff here, that we're trying to strike a balance. So that's the intention. And I thank you for that question. I am completely open to those. Oh, and then it, of course, says the loan must be amortized no later than 5 years after the date of the loan. So it's, again, somewhat arbitrary. It just, those of us talking about this thought that might be reasonable.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So we may be faced with having to come back to the legislature to put more money into this fund if grant funds are depleted and we need more. I'm just kind of calling that out. That may be a potential.
Yeah, I absolutely, Representative Haley, I think that is completely possible. I mean, none of us understands right now what the scope of this could be and what the needs could be. And I have to tell you, I spoke to Senator Benson today, just real briefly. The Senate is kind of thinking along the same lines. They have a little different approach. They're trying to strike the same kind of balance. And part of that is potentially having a lot more money available. So, you know, I hope we don't use up this fund. I hope the need is such that this money doesn't even go out. That's certainly possible. Maybe we've got five cases and that's it. But I kind of think not. So, oh, we have nine now. Okay, see that? So we have nine cases.
Can I ask additional clarification?
Please, Representative Haley.
And again, yesterday we heard from the Hospital Association the need for additional ICU beds and certain probably ventilator type equipment. Am I reading this right, that those would be loans because that would be permanent equipment, and the staffing, the overtime, the protective gear, those things fall all into the grant bucket? Am I interpreting that correctly, what your intent is?
Yeah, Representative Haley, I think so. I didn't quite catch the last few things you mentioned, but I think you've got it right here, that the things that are, if you're building ICU beds and you're equipping things that, you know, I think it's kind of laid out here. But I do want to point out that this isn't just for everybody who asks, because there is some, you know, if you look at 2.19, the commissioner may make grants and no interest loans to eligible providers that demonstrate a need on an urgent or emergency basis to plan for, prepare for, or respond to a communicable disease outbreak that has occurred or is likely to occur. And then there are things about, you know, how the money can be used. But this is, you know, urgent or emergent. And then the things that the commissioner is to consider, especially important, is the needs across the system So we want the commissioner to be seeing where the outbreak is occurring and where, so if this is like in western Minnesota and that's where the concern seems to be, she has to be able to send the resources there. So this is, and choose to send them here, not there. That's part of this. Whether the eligible provider may be reimbursed from another source for the cost of planning for, et cetera. So a lot of systems are gonna bill for the services. And, you know, if they're gonna get reimbursement, if they have other things available to them, they should go there, not to this fund. And whether the eligible provider lacks sufficient access to other resources to respond or would be financially at risk without a grant or loan. So I'm expecting that large systems that have other resources that may have, you know, excess assets someplace, that may have, you know, even the ability to go to a bank, would go to a bank, and that the commissioner is going to be able to make some decisions, because this obviously may not be enough money to do everything that everybody wants. So the fact that hospitals are coming in and saying we have all these needs, it's going to be, we're trying to put enough money in to meet the needs that have been expressed, and at the same time say, yeah, but we're going to look at that a lot more closely before the money goes out the door.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And one last question. I know you've got other people on your list. This kind of going back to the contingency fund, and you know the insurers have agreed that they won't charge for the tests, et cetera. Can any of that contingency fund be requested for uncompensated care in lieu of insurance, or is we're not saying that that's an appropriate use of the contingency fund? I just wanted to be clear on that.
Okay. Well, yeah, that I don't think it's not contemplated that that's one of the uses of the fund. I mean, actually, we did talk about this issue, and again, you know, members can disagree with me, and we can discuss this. But I think where I come down on this is that a lot of our systems do a certain amount of uncompensated care, and that's a lot of them do that under their community benefit requirement. And it's kind of part of their mission in a sense. And I don't think at this moment where we're dealing with emergencies, we're gonna really be able to change our whole payment system and so on and just say, oh, we're not gonna give you uncompensated care. I think that would be too broad of a brush. At the same time, I want people without insurance not to be deterred from seeking care. And people with out-of-pockets and high deductibles and stuff not to be deterred from seeking care, because that is to the benefit of all of us if people seek the care they need. So that's, we're trying to strike that balance. And there's been a lot of discussion about it. Honestly, there's just no perfect way to do this. We have such a complicated health care system that it's really hard to sort of streamline this piece of it on the fly, but would love to hear your thoughts about it if you have any, either now or later. Thank you. No, Representative Haley.
Thank you for answering all those questions.
Representative Keel.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I have a few questions also. On page 5, 5.8 through 5.12, 1-2, I understand there's I'm looking at the data. So are there any concerns about this data? Being this bill was heard in judiciary, but this is not the language they heard, correct?
Thank you for the question, Representative Kiel. Let me explain the process here. Because we're moving the bill very quickly, we have a clone bill. And the clone bill is right now in judiciary, and it's actually going to be heard this evening. But there's an amendment that's come forward kind of in, you know, I sit on the Judiciary Committee, and, you know, I'm not the data expert for sure, but we are, as a committee, we're kind of a mind, I would say, about handling of data. Mm-hmm. And so when some concerns came forward about the way this was originally drafted, an amendment was drafted. It hasn't been adopted yet because the bill didn't move, and we can't do that till this evening in Judiciary. But Ms. Clarkfist put it in this draft just so that we'd have it kind of the up-to-date version, not that it won't be amended again, but just so that you'd see it in this version. So I guess if we're adopting this, we've adopted it, but if there, the way this is working is if there's a change in the Judiciary Committee, we will bring that change forward and make sure it gets into the bill. So, and it, so the bill will be going to Ways and Means. It's not going to the floor. And so there's time for that, so we can catch up with any amendments that are done in that committee or we any that would have been done in GovOps that it went through. So that's kind of how the process will work. Okay. So thank you for raising that issue.
Thanks.
Representative Keel.
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair. I appreciate that. So out of the rural person is coming. How are we considering the geographic access that we are going to need so that, you know, whether we've got a critical access, and I think you kind of referred to this, but where, how are we going to balance that so that the requests that need to be handled, and I think I'll add this to it right now. I have what is called non-emergency medical transporters. How are they going to deal with giving someone a ride to the clinic or, you know, they do those things in rural Minnesota. How are we going to expect them to be protected and or take people places that they need to go maybe to be tested or whatever? How do we help them? Their finances are very tight, and I'm a little concerned about that group.
All right. I'm going to let the Department of Health answer that. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair. For the record, my name is Diane Rydrick. I'm the Director of the Health Policy Division at the Department of Health. And Representative Keel, to your question, one of the things that we've discussed as we've been looking at this language is the fact that we have our local public health outreach and support areas within the department and EPI staff and infectious disease staff within the department. We would envision that the process for reviewing applications would include people from both of those areas, and it would be administered by our Office of Rural Health and Primary Care. So I think between that subject matter expertise around the department, we'd be able to assess which facilities or provider types might be most vulnerable, including those in rural areas that are already a little financially frail in some cases. We'd be able to track where the outbreak might be most severe and where we anticipate that the need relative to the population is higher. And then we've got the epidemiology staff who can help us assess whether the what the funds are being requested for really makes sense in terms of best practices and guidance from CDC and others. So I think we'd be able to bring together a team to help us assess applications in that light so we can be looking at where the most urgent need is and where we think there is an ability of a facility to absorb that or not, so we can address it that way. Related to the other question, I don't think, to paraphrase Representative Liebling's language, I don't think the bill right now contemplates the non-emergency transport. It does allow grants to be used for additional emergency transport for patients, but we hadn't discussed non-emergency transportation needs and how those might fit in.
Okay. Thank you, Madam Chair. I would urge the department to think about this because I think this could be a real challenge in moving people should there be an outbreak, where they go. You know, some people are transported by way of their private homes, but there are group areas, and I'd be concerned about how we could end up sharing. You know, someone driving could be picking it up, and certainly they're going to watch out for it, but their finances are pretty fragile, and of course they have to drive quite a few miles in order to get someone where they need to go. So, and we're going to have to rely on them because our emergency services aren't going to have, you know, in some cases there will be some problems with that. So, and I just want to make sure that we balance the loan and grants amongst all of the state. And I realize that there's going to be some places that could end up being hot spots, but that we make sure that we're looking through the whole state. So thank you.
Okay, Representative Knorr.
Thank you so much, Madam Chair. Thank you for bringing this bill forward and making the amendments ready to go. I have a question about the reporting requirement on this bill. You can certainly look at subdivision 9. I know it's a narrow-based reporting process. I was more interested to know, are we going to get the account of loans or grant made during the calendar year, because this specifically says 2 years, and it's only to the leadership level and not to the legislative body. So I just wanted to inquire about that.
Okay, thank you, Representative Noor. Do either of you want to address that? Ms. Rybich?
Yeah, Madam Chair and Representative Noor. The way I read line 4.20, it's in each of the 2 years following. So if there are grants or loans that are awarded in calendar year 20, there would be a report that comes in January of 21 and then the following year too. So we interpret that to mean we're reporting back to you in each January after grants or loans are awarded. Much of the legislative language that we see when we're required to do a report directs us to give information to the chairs and ranking members, but that could certainly be modified if needed, or we could post information on our website or do other things to make it more broadly available.
Representative Noor?
Madam Chair, I'd like to see this being more explicit, rather than, showing that it's going to be done based on each year rather than the way it's written right now. And also like to see it sent to the entire body rather than just having posted on the website and giving to the ranking members from different political parties, so that we all have the same information and we can be able to share that with our constituents. Also, we wanted to make sure that we know how much it's going to cost, the administrative fee. It's not defined. I don't know if it's capped at 4% or 3%. Whoever is going to be administering the program, how much is it going to cost in terms of doing the administration?
Ms. Ryder, can you address that, please?
Madam Chair and Representative Noor, I don't think we know at this point. Until today, we haven't known what the size of the pot would be, the pool would be. Nor do we know at this point how many grants or loans might be administered out of this. The language is written in such a way that there is authority to use funds to administer the process. So for FTEs that would be needed to, review applications and process and do the appropriate oversight of grants or loans. But we'll have to work with Representative Liebling to cost that part out.
Thank you. Representative Noor?
No, thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you. And Representative Noor, one thing I just would say is that, it's true that what Ms. Rydrick says about a lot of legislation says send to the chairs and the ranking members. And Representative Schulmacher is not here, but I'll tell you, we get a lot of stuff, tons of stuff. And I would just say be careful what you wish for, because it's really a lot. And I understand this one has high interests and sensitivities, and I have no problem. I'm sure no one has any problem getting it out to whoever wants it. But maybe it would be better to post it somewhere rather than, I don't know about you, but my mailbox gets very cluttered. Representative Noor?
That was exactly what I was going to say. I always go to the department's website to look for the report so that I can view what happened. So this will be helpful if I can get the same report online.
Yeah.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you. Let's see. I don't know. Let's go to Representative Schultz.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I just want to thank you and all the others who I know worked really late last night putting this bill together. I just have a comment on the condition of accepting grants or loans. I actually would like to see language that puts limits on the amount that providers can charge for out-of-network care if they accept a grant or a loan. So this is what will help on affordability, and we can talk offline, but I think we want to put some structure so we can still make it affordable when people are forced to go out-of-network and they're not responsible for that additional cost.
Thank you, Representative Schultz. I think that's a great idea. I guess I was sort of under the impression we were going to do that in another bill, but I think it wouldn't be, it's never bad, people have been around here a while know you can do things in multiple places, so.
And Madam Chair, I think it'd be better to attach it to the conditions of the grant or loan. It might be easier to do it.
And the other, to that point, I think by putting it in here, one of my intentions was that entities that are applying would already understand what their obligation's going to be. It might impact the amount of what they ask for. So, I think it is good for them to understand up front what their costs might be. So I think that's a great idea. I'm just kind of wondering here if we can go a little bit over. Are we able to do that? Okay. So, yeah, so I think, members, even though we're kind of at the end of our time, if it's okay with everybody, we're going to go over a little bit. We've got more questions. Representative Moran.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So this may be a question for you, Chair, or for the testifiers, I don't know. But we are providing grants and loans to providers in case there's an epidemic, a crisis, so that they can respond to the crisis. And I don't know if that is like an ambulance to come pick someone up and they need to go to the hospital, if it's that minute, or if it's more of an epidemic crisis, if something happens, whether it's in the urban community or the rural or the suburban, it is to respond to the need, just in case hospitals or the providers do not have that initial capacity to do it in their current form. So can we just speak to that so we can be, so I can be maybe clearer on why we're providing the grants and the loans?
Mr. Ryderick, do you want to try that?
Sure.
Take that one. I've talked a lot this hearing.
Sure, Madam Chair and Representative. So the way that the language is written, I would interpret it to be, this is for situations where a provider, it could be a hospital, it could be a community health center or an FQHC, it could be a nursing home, where they are unable to deal with kind of a rising tide of cases that they need to see, whether it's for testing or for treatment. So it could be that they need more personal protective equipment and they don't have the resources to provide it. It could be that they need to create isolation rooms or spaces for quarantine and they're not able to deal with that. So it's not so much, you know, one patient and how they would deal with one patient, but are they equipped to handle a rising number of cases that are coming to their facility beyond what they would normally be expected to be able to handle? And do they need supplies, equipment, extra beds, more staff, more overtime, interpreters, hotlines, things like that?
Thank you. Thank you. Representative Haley.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Getting back to, let's see, so page 6. In the other account, we listed language that said if we didn't use the $21 million, it would go back to the general fund. Here we don't state that. Again, I guess I'm being really optimistic and positive. I'm wondering, should we just add that either that's additional $20 million that you're transferring to the contingency account, if it's not used, either comes back to this revolving account or general fund, and should we do the same thing for the paragraph above 6.20, if we don't use the $79 million, that it revert back to general fund? Just a thought.
So thank you for that question. So what we're doing here with this, with the loan grant fund is a new fund. And frankly, it should have been a fund that we had set up before. It would have been so much better. I mean, we have this public health contingency account, which was set up a few years ago, and I'm so glad it's there already. And we should have had something like this as well, and we didn't. So my thought is this is something that can be tweaked in the future. We'll see how it works, but we should have something like this available. The idea of clawing back the money, you know, when we did the money that we already appropriated, in fact, we had kind of a dispute with the Senate over that very issue that you brought up, and we let it go because we didn't want to fight about it. We wanted the money to go out the door. But in fact, the DFLers who were involved with it really did not agree with it, and I think the Department of Health also had, if I'm not mistaken, they were not fond of that provision. My thought about it is that this is a fund where the money stays here unless it's used. And so we can, when the legislature always has the ability to either add or take money out of a fund. So I don't see the need for clawbacks, and, you know, it just, I think it's better for us to put, you know, we should have a more reason kind of long-term, what baseline amount of money should sit in these funds. I think that's a very fair discussion. But for right now with this, I just think we'd be better off to just, you know, the money's there unless it's used. And then when we come back in session, if we say, oh my gosh, we had $50 million sitting in there and we don't need that there and we got some other use, we can move it and take it out, you know. So I just would rather not do that at this point. Now, we may end up there, I don't know, because the Senate may you know, that may be part of the negotiation. I don't know, but I don't think that's necessary.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And my questions today really were just for me to fully understand the mechanism we're setting up. So I understand your intent and how I should be reading the language. So that was my goal today.
Thank you so much. Representative Franza.
So this was to my amendment, Madam Chair.
You ready to move your amendment?
Okay. Well, I wanted to talk about the amendment. We're not going to offer it. I think there still needs, I had heard through the grapevine you had some reservations on it.
Yes.
This has to do with adding child care facilities, family child care programs, schools, or other facilities or setting that serves a vulnerable population that may be disproportionately impacted by a communicable disease outbreak. I still believe that we need to include. And so if we can continue, and I'm sure you'll be talking to MDH some more and hopefully DHS, another provider brought up the potential or the question of what's the plan for providers that are receiving questions from parents regarding this. Some providers are getting notifications of potential school closings. What's the plan for kids that have nowhere to go? Is there going to be flexibility in numbers? These are all questions that need to be asked as well. And hopefully some answers, because we don't want providers freaking out either. They're doing the best that they can as well during this time of unknown.
Thank you, Representative Franson. I really appreciate those concerns. I really do. My concern about putting this on this bill is, first of all, it's kind of a little, we recognize that there are going to be many, or there could be many kinds of impacts on many different organizations and sectors of our economy and businesses, and I appreciate your concern. I mean, I think we should all be very concerned about this, and, you know, if places of work close, people have to, if childcare facilities close, people can't go to work. So there's a lot of concern here. That said, this is not healthcare facilities, which the bill is kind of dealing with the healthcare sector. And then this is kind of the next ring out. And part of my concern is that if we included this, it would blow up the cost. But also, I think we need to deal with this you are so right, we really need to be thinking about this. I don't even know if this is something the Department of Health is, if this is even within their scope. Maybe I could ask them to comment on that. If you're aware of, or where the planning would take place for this kind of thing, because I don't even think it's Health Department planning. Ms. Kelly?
Madam Chair, Representatives, that's a really good question. We are concerned about the health of people in the workforce and encourage them to stay home if they're not well and go home if they're feeling unwell. And clearly, if parents access daycare and they are sick, our recommendation is that families, that parents who are ill keep their kids home. I mean, if they have COVID or find somebody else to care for their kids, that self-isolation means that you isolate yourself from others in your house even, or the whole house isolates together. So it could be a problem, and if daycare employees become sick, there could be staffing shortages at daycare as well. We have not had conversations yet with the Department of Human Services about how they, within their grant programs, may be able to address these issues. We are working with other state agencies and reaching out to the business community to talk about what issues and concerns they have and what recommendations we may have for them. But like you said, Chair, that the scope of this bill has been about the healthcare system, and we did not address other sectors of the economy or business community in this bill.
Yeah, thank you. And that, thanks for that reminder. I mean, these facilities are under DHS rather than MDH. Right. And so I think we need to get them into the conversation. Unfortunately, we don't have time to do that today. I mean, I appreciate members' indulgence staying late. We could have this, obviously, we have a lot more discussion we need to have on this as it moves along. And I really appreciate everybody's help. And we'll thank you so much for all the concerns that have been expressed and the very good questions. And this is really going to help us. You know, none of us is as smart as all of us. I really think that's a very true statement that Governor Dayton used to have posted in his office, I guess. And it's so very true. And we have a lot of good resource in this state, especially the, you know, good, hardworking, and thoughtful people in this body and in our agencies. So I think we're, and in the Senate. So with that, members, I'm going to renew my motion that House File 3980, as amended, be recommended to be re-referred to Ways and Means. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
All opposed, no. The motion prevails. Thank you. We are adjourned.